On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman was convicted of masterminding a cruel plot to murder a wheelchair-bound man.
A paramedic went over, said he has a belt around his neck, and he has literally split open from the heat.
9 o'clock a.m., a detective
gets down on my face and said, "Your fingerprints are all over his house. I was his cab driver. You're gonna find my fingerprints everywhere."
Then Connie Keel tells her story. She allegedly participated in the robbery and murder of a liquor store clerk.
We're going down the highway. All of a sudden, all these cops were coming around us, and we were arrested right there.
The evidence clearly showed that Connie was not just a ride-along, but she was there acting as a lookout. She knew that a robbery was going to take place.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Rowena Ashing and Connie Keel. At 2:15 a.m. on August 10, 1992, fire crews responded to a rapidly burning house fire in the northwest section of town.
There were civilians standing on this sidewalk in a semicircle screaming, "There's someone in there, he's an invalid, he's in a wheelchair."
But it was too late for 57-year-old Tom Bauer, a disabled man whose body was discovered inside.
There was evidence at the scene that this was a homicide.
Police brought 38-year-old cab driver Rowena Ashing in for questioning. She'd recently been accused of stealing $500 from Bauer, who was one of her regular customers. Soon, Rowena, her 25-year-old boyfriend Jeff Ramsey, and three others were arrested and charged with the gruesome killing, which left the working-class steel town shell-shocked. Was Rowena Ashing the mastermind behind a cool-blooded murder, or was she unfairly implicated by her boyfriend and his cohorts?
I was born in Granite City, Illinois. I was the oldest child of my mother and father's marriage.
Rowena grew up in a family of five kids. As she remembers her childhood, she did not have a good relationship with her mother, who was on her second marriage.
I'm not gonna be one of these people that blames all their background on their mother, okay? But my mother was an extremely abusive individual. And some of the scars I carry today are from my mother.
Rowena felt that she was the focus of her mother's rage because Rowena was one of her father's favorites.
Maybe she felt threatened by the fact that I got along well with my father. My mother was 5 foot tall, 197 pounds. She had a backhand would have made Babe Ruth green within me.
By Rowena's account, as she entered high school, things at home only got worse.
The day before my 15th birthday, she got mad at me because I was on the phone and I said, "Well, you just can't talk to nobody around here." She took the phone and wrapped it around my neck, tried to choke me.
These claims of abuse are backed up only by her daughter, Loretta, who says she learned of the abuse from her mother and aunts.
My grandmother was very abusive, especially towards my mom. My grandfather never hit my grandma, but one time he did put her against the wall and let her know not to be hitting the kids anymore because she was just that far out of it.
According to Rowena, by the end of high school, her mother became less abusive to her. But nonetheless, Rowena was eager to leave Granite City and planned to enlist in the military as a way out.
Yeah, I had it all set. I was gonna go join the Uncle Sam's Air Force. Well, I want to take my physical to be in the Air Force, and they said, "Well, you're pregnant." I said, "You're crazy."
The father was Rowena's high school sweetheart, who also had plans to join the Air Force.
Well, his mother was very adamant that he was going in the service. And when my father's mother found out that my mother was pregnant, he got shipped off a little faster. It was really a tough thing at that time.
Rowena was so determined, she was even willing to leave her newborn baby, whom she had named Loretta, in the care of her mother, despite their rocky past.
My mother was gonna actually go in the service and leave me with my grandmother.
She was gonna take care of my child and I was gonna go into the Air Force anyway.
But 6 months into her pregnancy, Rowena's mother was admitted to the hospital.
She went for gallstones. The doctor had told her, he said, Noni, you're 197 pounds, 3/4 of your heart is not good. He said, I can guarantee you, if you don't lose some weight when you go in there, he said, I'm not gonna guarantee your chances of survival. And she said, I'll operate on me anyway.
Rowena's mother never made it home, dying from complications from the surgery. In May of 1973, Rowena gave up her dream of joining the military when she gave birth to her daughter, Loretta.
I was born 3 months after my grandmother passed away, so it was a very tough time emotionally for my mom.
I left my daughter with my dad because I could see some of the things that I was doing with her, my mother was doing with me. And rather than put her through that, I told Dad, I said, I can't do this to my child.
In late 1973, Rowena took off with a friend to Louisiana, and it was there she met Tom Ashing. The two quickly fell in love, and by May of 1974, they were married. Rowena then decided to focus on raising a family.
I guess I was about a year old. She came back with Tom, which is my stepdad. He raised me from the time I was a year old.
Tom and Rowena settled in Louisiana and eventually went on to have two more children. To support the family, Rowena worked odd jobs, while Tom drove trucks and took on seasonal work on offshore oil rigs.
Being raised in the Midwest, I dreamed of the little white picket house, you know, the whole nine yards. The husband should go to work and the mom stays home and keeps house and blah, 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 blah. And of course, that didn't happen, but the reality of it is, he really, 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 really liked other women. I mean, I'm not gorgeous enough, but I'm not a bad looking woman. These women he run around with were, oh my God. The stringy hair, the buck teeth, you know, they just were not gorgeous. So I was like, okay. And I figured there had to be something I could do. There was nothing I could do to change him.
In 1991, after 17 years of marriage, Rowena and Tom filed for divorce. The single mother moved back to Granite City, Illinois, renting an apartment with her 8-year-old son and 16-year-old daughter, Nona. Loretta was 18 and living on her own. To make ends meet, Rowena landed a job as a cab driver.
I got to meet some strange people, but I got to meet a lot of nice ones too. And it was just, it was great. I enjoy the intermingling with people.
One of her regular customers was Tom Bauer. Bauer was confined to a walker and a wheelchair.
Tom was, he was a local person. I believe he was 57 years old. He had some drinking problems, could not get around. He had to rely on other people to help him, had people that helped clean his house. And he relied a lot on the local cab company to go in and pick things up for him and take him places.
Take him to go get his medication. I'd take him to go pay bills. I'd take him wherever he needed to go. I did his shopping for him. He'd make me a list, give me the money. I'd bring his stuff back.
Tom Bauer hadn't always been so dependent on others. In the mid-1980s, he was struck by a mysterious illness.
Thomas Bauer had been married for some time and began to exhibit a number of illness symptoms. They finally determined that he had been poisoned over a fairly long period of time by his wife, who was spiking his iced tea with arsenic. It was an attempt for her to get him to stop drinking. It crippled him. It left him largely confined to a wheelchair. It was just one of those tragic stories that, you know, that when you cover it as a reporter, you just keep looking at it and going, why do these things happen?
Well, he needed somebody to talk to sometimes, and he'd pay me to talk to him. He told me about how unhappy he'd been with his first wife and how come she came to do what she did to him. And
Rowena's job with the cab company had also put her in touch with Jeff Ramsey, a 25-year-old cab driver who'd already had a number of scrapes with the law since he went AWOL from the Army. The charges included assault, battery, and armed robbery.
I didn't know too much about him, but, you know, he said all the right things that I wanted to hear. I mean, the man's a really, you know, nice-looking young man, you know. So, of course, I took up with him for a while.
He made her feel younger. He catered to my mom's needs. And made her feel special. He was a player, type of guy that'd tell you exactly what it is you want to hear and just to get you to do whatever it is he needs you to do at that time.
Before long, Jeff quit his job at the cab stand and moved in with Rowena. According to Rowena, he relied on her to pay the bills. He also began to surround himself with a group of young guys who appeared to look up to him.
I think he was just trying to start up his own gang type of thing. So, kind of like Godfather type mentality.
Jeff Ramsey's crew consisted of John McIntyre, Bob Killer Russell, and Richie Loftus.
They thought Jeff was this big guy because he did have a record, you know. At the same time, they were scared of him because he had a record. And Jeff made sure they knew, you know, that about the violent past.
On August 9th, 1992, Rowena revealed to Jeff that one of her most loyal customers, Tom Bauer, had accused her of stealing $500.
He called me at the cab stand, and he said, he was just all out of bent out of shape. You took my money. I'm going to put you in jail.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
Rowena indicated to him that she wanted Tommy Bauer taken out. I believe it was even mentioned to burn him out.
In August of 1992, Rowena Ashing was working as a cab driver in Granite City, Illinois, to support her two youngest children. Her oldest daughter, Loretta, now 18, was living on her own. One of her regular customers, 57-year-old Tom Bauer, had accused Rowena of stealing $500 and had even filed a report with the Granite City Police Department. Just after 2 a.m. on August 10th, neighbors on Illinois Avenue in Granite City reported seeing smoke and flames coming from inside the house of Tom Bauer. The fire department arrived on the scene.
There were civilians standing on this sidewalk in a semicircle screaming, "There's someone in there, he's an invalid, he's in a wheelchair, we know that he's in there." As the smoke rose, we found the victim. He was dead. The paramedic went over, said he has a belt around his neck and he has literally split open from the heat. We knew that this wasn't a fire victim because he had been strangulated.
Investigators from the Granite City Police Department were called to the scene.
Water's dripping on you, everything's burnt. I walked over and saw the deceased on the bed, and it was pretty obvious what it was, a homicide.
Well, this is the murder weapon, which is a very key part of evidence. And it's believed that this was his belt that he wore around his pants, and the suspects took off of the pants and then wrapped it around his neck.
One of the main key elements of this crime was a frying pan that the perpetrators used to hit him in the head with. And pieces of this frying pan was even underneath his body.
This ended up being the bottom of a frying skillet, and it used such a force that it actually broke the bottom of the skillet out. There was also a rug that was placed over the body. That's uncharacteristic for someone sleeping to have a rug over them. And through the investigation, it was later determined that was actually used in the crime.
It's troublesome to a police department and to a community when you have someone like Mr. Bauer who is unable to get around, for someone to come in and use these means to take his life.
Police began to look at anyone who may have had a recent dispute with Tom Bauer, and discovered that he'd recently accused Rowena Ashing of stealing from him. Although he relied on her as a cab driver and a friend, she was also the one person who had access to his home.
He made an accusation through a police report that he had sent her to the bank to withdraw some money. That money never made its way to him. I believe it was $500. That is a huge red flag to an investigator.
Police brought Rowena in for questioning, first asking her about the theft and then the homicide.
9 o'clock a.m., detective in Granite City hauls me in and took me to jail. And he's telling about this house fire on 2106 Illinois. I'm like, oh crap. And he comes in and he goes, "You know Thomas Bauer got killed?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." And he gets down in my face and said, "Your fingerprints are all over his house. I was his cab driver. You're gonna find my fingerprints everywhere."
A background check revealed that Rowena had been arrested a year earlier for stealing $2,500 from another elderly cab customer. Investigators asked Rowena to take a lie detector test about the $500 theft and to see if she knew anything about Bauer's death.
First she said no, then she went on and said, "Yeah, I'd take it." After she failed to be truthful on the polygraph, indicates to us that we got somewhere to start now on this crime.
If she had nothing to hide, why was she being deceitful? At that point, did we know that she was involved beyond any shadow of doubt? No. But it gives you an avenue as an investigator to travel on to try to determine if she knows more about this than she's leading us to believe.
According to police, although the results showed Rowena was being deceitful, police had no evidence linking her to the murder. But they did have enough to arrest and charge her with theft. Still, with no solid leads, police turned to her boyfriend, 25-year-old Jeff Ramsey, who denied knowing anything about the killing. Then, according to reports, Jeff's 23-year-old brother Stephen came forward. He'd heard something on the news and became suspicious that his older brother was somehow involved.
Steve Ramsey had spoke with his brother and came out and told the investigators, you need to talk to him further, there's more people involved.
The biggest break came from the youngest member of Jeff Ramsey's crew, 18-year-old John McIntyre, who'd been brought in for questioning. He told investigators a story of how Rowena approached Jeff with a plan to keep Tom Bauer from going to the police. As an incentive, Rowena promised that they would find money once they entered the house.
And she indicated to him that she wanted Tommy Bauer taken out. I believe it was even mentioned to burn him out. Rowena told him that there was going to be $1,500, a TV, VCR, go in there, rough the guy up, take him out, and you can find the money, the equipment, and they would split that. It's our belief that Rowena's sole purpose in any of this was to have Tommy Bauer killed so he couldn't testify against her on this theft case. So her whole motive was to use somebody else to take out what she perceived as her problem.
They got together at the pool hall sometime after midnight. They had to go by the gas station, get 60 cents worth of gas in a clear plastic jug.
The four gentlemen parked down the street, about two blocks away, carrying the container of gasoline, went to Tommy's house, peeled open a screen, crawled in through the back window, and while they were walking through the kitchen, one of them picked up a large frying kitchen skillet. They also had a rug. Tom Bauer only knew one of them, Jeff Ramsey, and they wanted to cover the face of Tom Bauer so he wouldn't see Jeff Ramsey.
Jeff Ramsey asked McIntyre to find out where the money was. At that time, Tom Bauer says, I don't have any money. I spent it all on bills.
He was then struck in the head twice with the skillet, so hard that it busted the bottom of the skillet out. They then take the belt off of him, wrap it around his neck, and strangle him the whole time with the whole intent of killing him.
According to McIntyre, he went through the house looking for additional money and couldn't find anything. After they couldn't find the money, they decided to burn the place, at which time John McIntyre took the gas can, sprinkling gas over the body of Tom Bauer, along with his bed and the walls, and then lit it.
Part of John McIntyre's confession was backed up by a second member of Ramsey's crew, 26-year-old Richie Loftus, who'd acted as the driver. But these statements alone weren't proof that Rowena Ashing ordered a hit on Tom Bauer. As Rowena awaited transfer to county jail on theft charges, she requested to speak with police one more time.
According to Rowena, she wanted to get it off her chest. She just couldn't go to county jail knowing that we didn't know the truth. She had nothing to do with it, according to Rowena. She was just a girlfriend of one of the people that was involved in the crime.
Rowena says trouble began when her boyfriend, Jeff Ramsey, discovered that Bauer had accused her of theft.
And I told him what went on, that he had accused me of stealing his money. I said, Jeff, I'll take care of it. Now, here's the thing. He wanted to be Mr. Macho, I'm going to take care of my woman thing. I said, Jeff, I can handle this. I will take care of it.
Rowena also claims to have had no idea Jeff would take matters into his own hands.
I would think Jeff thought he was doing something for me, because I took care of him, you know. I supported him, I fed him, I bought his clothes a little bit. So he didn't want anything to happen to that. He wanted me to be protected.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
So I'm sitting there in the holding cell. You know, just sitting there. All of a sudden, I'm all over the TV. I'm all over the newspapers. mastermind in murder.
And later on this episode of Women Behind Bars, Connie Keel is accused of participating in the robbery and murder of a liquor store clerk.
We're going down the highway. All of a sudden, all these cops were coming around us, and we were arrested right there.
In August of 1992, as news of the gruesome murder of Tom Bauer made local headlines, people in the community of Granite City, Illinois were left wondering how such a tragedy could have happened.
The facts around this case not only were very grisly, but it was a particularly nasty case because of Mr. Bauer's background. He'd been poisoned by his wife, he was left crippled, mostly confined to a wheelchair. And then to find out that he had been attacked so brutally like this was really beyond what we're used to seeing.
The Granite City Police Department's lead suspect was 38-year-old cab driver Rowena Ashing, who was already in jail on theft charges.
So I'm sitting there in the holding cell, you know, just sitting there. All of a sudden, I'm all over the TV. I'm all over the newspapers. Mastermind in murder.
Also in the news was Rowena's youngest daughter, Nona, who was tracked down by a local reporter. Nona, just 16 years old, defended her mom.
Nona, you were just questioned by police. Your mother was charged with murder and theft. How are you feeling about all this? Are you surprised?
Yeah, about the murder, I am. I mean, I can't believe they did it.
I think she gave the orders to strangle Bauer and to burn his house down? That's the kind of mother you have?
But that's what everybody's saying, but I don't think she really did it.
On August 17th, 1992, Rowena Ashing was charged along with Jeff Ramsey, John McIntyre, Bill Russell, and Richie Loftus with the murder of 57-year-old Tom Bauer.
In the state of Illinois, there's a part that's called accountability. If you're accountable for someone else's actions, you could face and will face criminal sanctions against you. Had it not been for her, they would not have been there.
According to police, the corroborating statements made by the members of Jeff Ramsey's crew were enough to charge Rowena with murder.
She ended up pleading guilty to the murder, basically the mastermind of the murder, only because her lawyer told her that if it went to trial, that there was no way that they would find her anything but guilty, and they would seek the death penalty. She would get a life without parole, and she would never get out and never see her children or her son again.
I think that Rowena is a killer. If you're innocent, to me, you're not gonna plead guilty to murder. You're gonna take it to trial, and had she been innocent, she would have chose to take that avenue. But it was obvious that she's guilty of this crime.
I was in total disbelief. I turned around, I said, how can you call yourself a judge, a learned counsel, and give me 40 years when you know I didn't do this? My son was there and he said, Jesus, mother, I'll be 48 when you get out of prison. I said, son, chill, come on now. And he was crying and everything, you know.
After 16 years behind bars, time served has been especially hard on her oldest daughter, 35-year-old Loretta.
Not having my mom, that would be the hardest. My mom wasn't, the lovey-dovey type, warm, loving mom. My kids every day. 1,000 times a day, they say, I love you. They say, I love you. And, you know, my mom missing out on what that life is like.
Rowena Ashing has served most of her sentence at a maximum security prison for women in Illinois.
I write poems, I write stories, I write books. I try to be a mentor to the younger women.
I try to tell them, look, they didn't put you here. You do what they tell you. That's the bottom line. You improve yourself. You don't sit here and feel sorry for yourself, because that makes your time just go drag.
Due to state sentencing reforms, her 40-year sentence was reduced to 20. She's expected to be released in the year 2012 and will be 58 years old. For the police officer who helped put Rowena Ashing away, her release is an unsettling notion.
Five people were taken off the street, and I believe that's the best that the state could do. It's troublesome to a police department that any murderer is walking the streets. I'll leave it at that. That's troublesome.
As for regrets, Rowena has a few.
It's got to do with the fact that I used poor judgment in the people I ran with. That's the bottom line on it. And that I started running around with Jeff. Because he was, you know, young and exciting and all this good stuff. You know, and I was bedazzled by it, as it were. And the regret of it is that the man died.
Next up on this episode of Women Behind Bars, a woman is arrested for the robbery and murder of a liquor store clerk.
We went in there, that parking lot, with the intentions to get some cigarettes from that liquor store.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to www.wetv.com. On February 26, 1980, in Northern California, 41-year-old Frank Gummer, a liquor store clerk, was found shot to death at his place of work. Gummer, a family man, worked at the liquor store part-time as his second job. The killing would be linked to Connie Keel, who, according to court documents, had sat in the getaway car waiting for her husband Ricky Keel and his cousin Jeffrey Taylor to exit the liquor store.
It was a very cold-blooded murder.
Connie would claim she had no prior knowledge of the robbery.
The evidence clearly showed that her presence there was not just a ride-along, but she was there acting as a lookout. She knew that a robbery was going to take place.
Did Connie Keel knowingly participate in the robbery and murder of Frank Gummer, or was she an innocent bystander?
I grew up in Santa Monica, California. I am the second to the oldest. My mother and father have four children. And then my father and his wife have four children.
Connie was real young. She was a beautiful kid.
But at 3 years old, Connie's childhood innocence came to an abrupt end when she claimed she was molested by a distant relative.
I had a lot of sexual abuse when I was a child.
The things that happened to those girls sexually was unbelievable.
Connie had no one to turn to when the alleged abuse began.
My mom had her own things going on with her own life. Her and my father were getting a divorce. I was pretty much alone. I wish I would have had the courage enough to tell somebody back then, but it wasn't something you did.
In 1965, Connie's parents divorced. Connie's mother won custody of the four children because Connie says her father could not afford to fight in court. Connie's father eventually remarried, but still stayed in touch with Connie and her siblings. But her life at home, with her mother, who was on welfare, was still a struggle.
I didn't have friends. I was adventurous because I didn't like being at home. I used to jump trains and ride the trains with the bums all the way to LA and back.
She started doing things that I wouldn't allow her to do. She's on the street too much.
At 15, Connie met a friend of her older brother, Ricky Keel, who was also 15 years old. According to Connie, Ricky's family was in the restaurant business.
When I first met him, we were young kids, and I thought he was arrogant and had everything he wanted, flaunted it. In the beginning of our relationship, he was really quite nice to me. His family owned restaurants, you know, and we'd go to his family's restaurant. He wined and dined me, and that's when I fell in love with him. He gave me the things I didn't have.
But there was another side to Ricky Keel.
He was still a little rebel. He just was more manipulative about the things that he did. He hid it well.
I'd met Ricky a few times. I knew there was trouble because the way he talked and people they ran with, the things they said. I knew there was going to be trouble.
For Connie, the trouble was just beginning.
As soon as he got me where he knew I cared about him, he started drinking a lot, and he started getting high.
At 16, Connie became pregnant with her daughter, Alicia. In January 1979, Ricky and Connie were married. Shortly after, they had another child, a boy they named Ricky.
She was a good mom. She played with him. She was a kid with him. You know, we'd go outside and play and kick it.
But life for the young couple was not easy.
Ricky and Connie's marriage was pretty rocky. Ricky loved the ladies. Connie put up with a lot of crap in that area.
His brutality increased. He started becoming very mean to other people around me. If he thought somebody was looking at me, he would approach them very violently. He scared me a lot.
Ricky and Connie used to get in some pretty good fights. Connie would be upset vocally, and Ricky would be upset physically.
I was always worried about Connie. He was kind of a crazy guy. Whatever he wanted to do, that's what they did.
He made all the decisions, and believe me, they weren't good decisions.
Connie claims that as her husband's behavior became more violent, she attempted to leave the marriage several times.
He would want to slap me around, punching me in the face, and telling me I wasn't going nowhere, pulling my hair.
Connie claims Ricky and his cousin Jeffrey became more involved in drugs, and according to court documents, Ricky was involved in criminal activity, including armed robbery. Connie feared for her children's safety.
They had been robbing liquor stores. I asked them to stop doing it, not to bring it around our family, but...
Less than a year into the marriage, a fearful Connie left Ricky, took her kids, and stayed at a relative's house.
He was doing things that I didn't agree with, and that's why I did leave him for a while, and because I didn't want to endanger my kid's life.
Ricky's family found out where she was staying and asked her to come back. Connie reluctantly returned. A month later, on February 26, 1980, Connie and Ricky went out for the night while his parents watched their kids.
The whole reason we were out that night was because his parents didn't want me to. They wanted me to try to work on the relationship. And so they encouraged us to go out that night.
According to court documents, Connie, Ricky, and his cousin Jeffrey Taylor ended the night by going to a local liquor store in Campbell, California.
We went in there, that parking lot, with the intentions to get some cigarettes from that liquor store. My husband's cousin, Jeff, he wanted to rob the liquor store. My husband said no, he didn't want to do it. He wasn't prepared to rob a liquor store. Jeffrey kept egging on my husband, Ricky, asking him to just come on, cuz, don't be a punk, we could do this. And I'll take the first shot, cuz. I pleaded with them, and they were just going to do what they were going to do. And maybe if I would have kept my mouth shut, maybe Ricky wouldn't have agreed to it. He said, I'm the one with the gun. You just shut up and stay here. And I did, and I just watched him walk out, get out of the car and walk in the liquor store. I can't even tell you why I sat there. I could have left. The keys were in the car was running. I could have just gotten the driver's seat and took off. But I didn't.
At 11:30 p.m., Ricky Keel and Jeffrey Taylor went into the liquor store with firearms while Connie waited in the car. According to the prosecution, Connie's role was more than just an innocent bystander.
Sometime around midnight, the two male defendants came into the store armed with firearms and made the victim turn over the money from the cash register.
Of the $210 Ricky and Jeffrey took during the robbery, some were bills that had been marked Garden City Liquors. These marked bills, also known as bait money, were meant to help identify cash taken in the event of a robbery. Ricky and Jeffrey did not realize they had taken the marked money. Ricky and Jeffrey shot part-time liquor store clerk Frank Gummer four times with two different weapons. He died at the scene.
They filled him full of lead from their guns. Both of them shot him and killed him, and they both left.
There could be no other reason besides just being a monster to have shot and killed him, because he complied with him 100%.
Connie Keel sat in the car. She was aiding and abetting the commission of a robbery, which also turned out to be a murder.
Connie claims she was appalled when she heard the gunshots coming from the liquor store.
When I was sitting in that car, all I could think about was, how can I get out of here? How can I get out of here and get my kids?
According to Connie, she became even more frightened of Ricky because of his cold-blooded behavior.
They didn't run back to the car. They walked back to the car. They were like joking with each other.
They kept making fun of me because I was so upset over what they did. Once we got to my house, Ricky wouldn't let me leave his side. Everywhere I went, he had his eye on me.
He didn't trust me.
An eyewitness would later ID Jeffrey Taylor and Ricky Keel, but could not identify Connie in the car. When Women Behind Bars continues, Ricky and Connie are arrested for the murder of Frank Gummer.
We're going down the highway, and all of a sudden, all these cops were coming around us, and we were arrested right there.
In February 1980, Ricky Keel and his cousin Jeffrey Taylor committed a robbery that turned into a brutal murder. The entire incident was caught on a surveillance camera. But Ricky's wife, Connie Keel, who was in the getaway car, denied any participation in the crime.
The photos were a series of 35 millimeter photographs that had been taken by a hidden camera in the liquor store that showed not only the robbery, but the homicide. It showed Ricky Keel holding a bag while the clerk put the money from the till into the bag. The next photo showed Ricky shooting the clerk.
There was a lot of evidence for the investigators to go on. They had photographs which showed the defendants. They had description of the vehicle.
The police took the surveillance photos to local liquor stores in an attempt to ID the killers. Ricky Keel's uncle, who also owned a liquor store, and Ricky's father were there when the police arrived to show them the photos.
The detectives came and were showing those photographs of the murder. And my co-defendant's father identified him and told him where we lived.
It was Connie's father-in-law who identified his son Ricky in the photo and told police where the couple lived. However, according to court documents, Ricky's father also phoned ahead to warn the couple that the police were on their way. After attaining a search warrant, the police headed to the Keels' home.
My father-in-law sent my brother down to our house to tell us that the police were coming.
Before authorities arrived on February 28, 1980, Ricky and Connie left their two kids with a family member and drove off, hoping to elude the police. But they didn't get far. Shortly after they left their home, they were stopped by the police.
We're going down the highway. All of a sudden, all these cops were coming around us.
We effected a routine felony car stop, which includes drawn weapons and commands to the occupants to come out of the car one at a time.
When the defendants, including Connie Keel, were arrested, some of the bait money was found in her purse.
All three defendants were charged with first-degree murder and armed robbery. Although Connie did not actually enter the liquor store or pull the trigger, her presence in the car at the time of the robbery and murder made it possible for the police to charge her as well as her co-defendants. Connie was tried along with her two co-defendants, her husband Ricky and his cousin Jeffrey Taylor. Al Bender was the primary prosecuting attorney for the case.
This was a fairly complicated case, actually. It involved three defendants, one of which is Connie Keel. Her defense essentially was, let's see if there's enough evidence to prove that I was there and that I had that intent to facilitate the commission of the crimes. The other two defendants, their defense was one which we used to refer to as diminished capacity, which means, okay, I did it, but I was so high on drugs that I could not form the intent to commit the underlying crime.
There's not much in that trial that's about me, except that we got arrested together 2 days later. I had marked bills from that liquor store in my purse.
When we would go to court and Connie would be sitting up there, you know that she didn't belong there. Connie was guilty for a lot of things, like stupidity, but nothing like the degree of the charges that they were charging her for.
As the prosecution presented their case, the evidence unfolded.
As a part of the investigation, a search warrant was authorized at the place where the Keel family lived. They went back, dug up the area, they found the weapons used in the robbery murder. The evidence with reference to Connie Keel was on the thin side to start with, but got better during the trial.
The defense attorney for Ricky's cousin, Jeffrey Taylor, made an opening statement that even surprised the prosecution.
I'll never forget it. The attorney for Taylor said that a witness, the uncle of Ricky Keel, had seen Connie Keel the night before with a gun in her purse and said, "We're going to do a 211 tomorrow."
The prosecution believed that now they had the proof that Connie had prior knowledge of the robbery, also known as a 211. But on the stand, Ricky's uncle changed his story and denied ever seeing Connie with a gun. In the end, Connie did not testify at all, even in her own defense.
The reason I didn't put a defense on in my trial is because I believed that the case spoke for itself. They had pictures of the crime. I wasn't in the pictures. I didn't participate in the crime. I believed in the justice system.
On May 14th, 1981, the jury reached a verdict.
Every defendant was found guilty of murder in the first degree, which is the law when you commit a murder during the course of a robbery. The evidence clearly showed, and the jury agreed actually, that Connie was not just a ride-along, but she was there acting as a lookout, and clearly that she knew that a robbery was going to take place.
I was shocked when the verdict came back guilty for me. I thought that they would find me not guilty because I didn't participate in the crime, that my co-defendants actually did the crime.
When she got convicted of first-degree murder, that was worse than a nightmare.
I'm gratified that our system of justice prevails because it was a very cold-blooded murder.
I think her sentence was very harsh because, you know, she did try to stop them. She's not the one that actually pulled the trigger or committed the murder.
Connie and Ricky divorced while in prison. Connie's two children were raised by Ricky's parents. Connie was taken to a maximum security prison an hour east of Los Angeles to serve out her sentence. Ricky Keel and Jeffrey Taylor were sent to a men's correctional facility in California.
In the beginning of my prison term, I was very angry. I was angry at the system. I was angry at my co-defendant. I think I was just mad at everybody. I went through a lot of therapy here. I went to survivor of sexual molestation therapy here, and I did it for 6 years. And that's the best thing I ever did for myself. For a long time, I've been in a lot of pain. Pain for what happened. In this crime. Paid for what it did to my family. My children had to grow up without a mother and a father.
Connie Keel has been incarcerated for 27 years. She will be up for parole soon. She still thinks about the day Frank Gummer was murdered.
I wish I would have left that scene of that crime.
Even after all these years, it's horrible, you know? To sit there and listen to those shots go off makes me sad. He didn't do anything, you know, for them to take his life.
I want to go home. I want to go be with my children. I have grandchildren, and I have parents that are all elderly now. It's time for me to give back.